U.S. Representative Rodney Davis says he won't run for governor and will try to retain his congressional seat in a newly drawn district. Davis says he looks forward to a committee chairmanship if Republicans take the House next year. That story just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sensors embedded in roadways can improve bad weather service and save money.
That would enable street plowing teams to have a real-time understanding of which roads are accumulating more snow than others.
Hear about a vision of smart cities and how municipalities can decide which new techie tools to choose. And the Inclusive Education Coalition is planning how to buy new book titles for McLean County teachers to use in more diverse classroom curriculum. Those stories and a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal is preparing to work on new technologies that will make things run smoother, faster, and at less cost. Work sessions are likely early in the new year, but it's hard to say which so-called smart cities initiatives will work well in any given city. The Illinois Smart City and Region Association is a body that says it can help with that. Jill Gallo is the CEO. Smart cities can mean better administrative processes. They can mean better connectivity to smooth the way for municipal services to work. It can mean increased transparency for taxpayers, a variety of things. Joe Gallo says the question of what spaces offer the largest opportunities is a broad one.
If I had to narrow it down, I would think the biggest opportunities for communities in the smart city space would be around optimizing their operations. The narrative is that the cities or towns or villages are in a position to operate lean, few staff, limited resources. And so any opportunity that a community could utilize to automate a given process or increase sensors or softwares to create efficiencies within those operations would be beneficial for a community through the lens of a city administrator or a municipal decision maker, I would say.
Lay out some for instances, would you?
For instance, I'll give you one here, top of mind. When it comes to the upcoming winter season that we're approaching, one of the larger expense items in this time of year for us is our road salt. Our road salt requires us to have our public works street teams on call in addition to the regular schedule. And we in the city of Chicago and neighboring communities here can experience some adverse weather from time to time, especially large snowfalls. Now, we also know that in communities that are a little bit larger than others, that the level of snowfall accumulation isn't consistent uniformly across the community. And so if we were to deploy these precipitation sensors in our roadways, that would enable our street plowing teams to have a real-time understanding of which roads are accumulating more snow than others, because there's also climate conditions that play a factor. There's a level of traffic on a given road that can reduce the level of accumulation. And so if we deploy these sensors, one, we can target the roads that require more salt than others, given the accumulation factor, as well as then be more specific in our deployment of salt, which then translates to smarter buying for future years, because we can target instead of just blanket the community with salt. In addition to that, we can map out the critical roads in our infrastructure and ensure that those are receiving preemptive salt or maintenance salt as we go through them. And so what that would do is allow the snow plowers themselves a greater degree of control over their schedule, as well as the logistics for where they're covering. From the municipal director's perspective, they can utilize this information to reduce costs in future years.
Some of that's already being done. Most municipalities identify their main routes, the primary and secondary roadways that need attention. How much faster can these sensors deliver that information about the precipitation levels on specific roads?
With immediacy, this is real-time data for the accumulation of precipitation levels, as well as the condition of precipitation, whether water or frost or frozen. But ultimately, it's not just about identifying primary and secondary routes within the community, but it's about the ecology of the community and not just blanketing salt across all of our roads to ensure that they're clean, impacting our groundwater. So when we have a targeted approach to deploying salt, this enables us to reduce the amount of salt that's seeping into our groundwater and our ecology overall, as well as then impacting our finances going forward, utilizing the data from year after year if these sensors are deployed throughout a community.
Platforms and mechanisms are changing rapidly. How is a municipality to decide which modality of sensor or which software package is the best for it?
That brings us to the conversation about ISCRA and the Illinois Smart City and Region Association. And the reason I say this is because from a municipal perspective, here's the deal. When we have questions or conversations and we're looking for information and guidance, we can go to a number of agencies. If we wanted to talk about wastewater, I would go to the MWRD, or if I want to talk about drinking water, I'd go to JAWA, Joint Action Water Agency. If I want to talk about solid waste, refuse, and recycling, in my case, I would talk to SWANC, which is a solid waste agency of Northern Cook County. And of course, for transportation and roadways, I'd speak with IDOT. And for economic development, I would talk to the Chamber of Commerce. The interesting thing is that there isn't a singular space where municipal decision makers can go to speak specifically about tech that impact a broad facet of the community. And so what ISCRA has created is this agnostic ecosphere where those municipal decision makers can converge and solicit information and guidance on technology initiatives for their community. And what ISCRA does in this case, circling back to the conversation about precipitation sensors, is we bring multiple vendors that provide the same or similar technologies of an area and have the dialogue focused on the technology, its features, values, benefits, and what's advantageous. And when you have multiple vendors discussing this in front of municipal decision makers simultaneously, we then stay away from the individual lens of the one vendor and through the lens of their singular solution, opening up these siloed conversations.
Can you give an example of something that has resulted in good value for municipalities that has happened already, and acknowledging that you're in the early development of this area?
One of the most recent ones, given the pandemic that we just come through, however, still enduring it, we were able, from ISCRA's perspective, able to help the Casey Library District maintain continuity of operations when the shutdowns and the mandates were in full effect. Caseyville Library District is more than just the library in and of itself. They offer social services to its residents. They offer license and license plate services, as well as other social service and welfare issues through their district. And we were able to connect them through the dialogue that they were having through ISCRA's platform with an organization that could enable a quick pilot for Caseyville Library District to maintain their continuity of operations. So that would be one of the more recent successes that's transpired through this dialogue, allowing them, the municipal decision maker, to feel free to ask questions, to look for action items without being guarded that they're being sold something. ISCRA removes that level of solicitation and keeps it purely about education and guidance.
Another area in which smart cities ideas are percolating is access to information in municipalities. What are some of the ways that you are seeing that develop, both in Europe and here in the U.S.?
Recently, I read about a suburb that's utilizing the electrical smart grid and its network capacity to tie in their water meters or their community's gas meters. And this enables the community to not have to build redundant networks, but it enables the community to piggyback on an existing network, which then offers the resident or the citizen the ability to log into a dashboard and see real time the information usage of their water or gas, as well as allowing the municipality to see the real time usage of the citizen's water and or gas. And having that information enables either party to make decisions or judgments about how to pull back or throttle forward.
Smart city technology spending reached about $80 billion in 2016. It was expected to grow to about $135 billion by this year from an older report from the International Data Corporation. What do you see as the growth trend?
The growth is going to continue. And as it continues, the growth is going to be accelerated more dramatically given our current climate, not necessarily the weather-related climate. However, that is a major component in the adoption of smart city technologies, but the climate in which we are currently living within in terms of how we go to work on a daily basis or how we don't travel to work on a daily basis. The need to be more accommodating and amenable to adopting technology is becoming something that we can no longer just recognize. We have to embrace and start acting toward. So I see strong growth.
Municipalities may be hesitant to get on board this. Gotcha. They may not see the benefits right away. It is a big chunk of money. How do you make the case to municipalities that they ought to put a marker on this?
There's a saying that advancement and progress are carried on the back of criticism, right? And by criticism, I don't mean cynical comments or cynicism in general. I mean, looking at something through a critical lens. Now, what I would prefer to say is that advancement and progress are planted in the seeds of education and cultivated through criticism, in the sense that progress and advancing in an area cannot be done unless those who are going through those motions are completely and fully educated on what they're about to experience. Once they're fully knowledgeable, they can then step back and take a critical examination of it that they're doing or of it that they're experiencing and say, there has to be a better way. Now, simultaneously, paralleling that, there are technologists out there providing solutions that answer that critical question, or here are a number of better ways. And what happens in the current state in which we live, municipal decision makers are becoming less siloed and more collaborative. And when you or they can recognize that solutions are providing value, and if these solutions are compounded by their neighboring communities adopting them at the same time, providing intrinsic value to the residents who don't necessarily recognize the borders of a given community because they're equally at home in their neighboring communities, we'll see those municipal decision makers become more eager to engage.
That's Joe Gallo, the CEO of the Illinois Smart Cities and Region Association. He's also the mayor of Rolling Brook, Illinois. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A group with roots in Unit 5 schools says social studies and history curricula need an urgent revamping. Normal Community High School senior Aditi Sharma founded the Inclusive Education Coalition last year. She tells WGLT's Lindsay Jones why students decided to lead the charge to diversify perspectives in Bloomington Normal schools.
I hadn't seen anything widespread or like significant. I know that we have so many great teachers. I know that they individually, on an individual scale, a lot of them worked to make their history classes more inclusive. But the problem is that the problem is within the system. It's not enough for an individual classroom to be teaching what needs to be taught. It needs to be systemic and it needs to be curriculum. The standards within the curriculums need to be changed so that it's just the new normal.
What prompted you to start this group?
Actually, the reason this organization, I founded it, the reason is I was at a school board meeting where the entire group of students, teachers, and parents that were there actually ended up walking out of the meeting when the board decided that they would be opening up schools during the pandemic. And so that sort of demonstration just inspired me to take action about these issues that really matter, especially during COVID. And like, I really resonated with the idea that education can help fix a lot of the issues that we have, because a lot of times people are biased just because they're ignorant or they haven't learned about a certain community of people or they haven't learned about a certain culture and they don't understand. And so education really is the first step, I think, in creating a better world, a more empathetic world. And so that's kind of what prompted me to start the organization.
You mentioned that you had this moment where you were just like, okay, I see what I've lacked in my education. I see what the curriculum has lacked. I see the perspectives that I've been missing out on. What were some of those perspectives? What did you see that you hadn't seen before?
You know, it was always like in elementary school, like the pilgrims and Indians, like they were friends, like they got along, like Thanksgiving, all of this. And like, we were just never really like thoroughly taught what the actual realities of these situations were. And so I think as I like grew, as I've grown up through this system, I see issues in every sort of aspect, especially in history. Even in classes like English, we focus on, you know, white authors, like Shakespeare, F. Scott Fitzgerald, but it's just, we don't get that representation that we need. The biggest thing for me has been that, like, I have had to teach myself so many things. The reason I know, like, most of the things I know is because I had to do readings outside of school. And
logistically speaking, how do you hope to kind of implement that systemic change? I mean, what are some, like, concrete actions that you're hoping to follow through with?
I guess in terms of, like, subject-specific, in history, we just want a more thorough representation of civil rights movements, of the Black community, of the Latinx community, just, you know, these marginalized peoples. We want a more thorough and broad understanding of these activist movements. And then I would say in health, you know, we want it to be inclusive of LGBTQ plus people, as well as, you know, a push away from, you know, the abstinence focused sex education. And then in English, we really hope to see more diverse authors represented in books about, you know, from the perspective of people of color, or about the lives of people of color, or LGBTQ plus people.
That was Inclusive Education Coalition founder Aditi Sharma with Lindsay Jones. Sharma says the group of nearly 30 students will fundraise and plan how to buy new book titles for teachers to use in the classroom. They hope to expand to more high schools next year. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Congressman Rodney Davis says he won't run for governor, but will instead run to retain a seat in the U.S. House in a newly drawn district. A Taylorville Republican says it was an easy decision.
Because it was always my first choice. It's something I was open and honest with anyone who asked. My first preference was to run for re-election, looking forward to helping Republicans take the majority back in the House here in Washington, and I'm looking forward to chairing the House Administration Committee. This should not be a surprise to anyone. When the maps were signed into law and we knew it became official, I made it known that my intention was to run for re-election in the district that is now the 15th district that includes my home and my home county of Christian County.
How much different is the district in makeup than your current one?
There's a lot of my district that is very familiar with me and very familiar with what we're doing in Congress because it's been in the same media market as much of my current district. But there's a lot of population that I still represent that used to be part of the old 13th district, my current 13th district. And a lot of areas that are new up in the northwest part of Illinois are areas that I've traveled in over my career and have built relationships and friendships, so much so that we've continued to travel in those areas for a wide variety of reasons throughout my time in Congress.
Is it a safer, redder district than the current one?
It's a gerrymandered district that's substantially more Republican than what my current 13th district was drawn to be 10 years ago. Remember, the district I currently represent was drawn to elect a Democrat 10 years ago, and we've won it five straight times. I'm looking forward to working in this new area, and a lot of the current areas that I have there that make up this new 15th district, too.
Many rural areas have moved in the last decade, as you noted, more conservatively. You have prided yourself on having a bipartisan approach and being centrist, and have some independent organizations back that up with ratings. Will the district make it more difficult for you to be that centrist person?
Well, not at all. I've continued to maintain my core values and conservative principles. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that we can't work together on issues that positively affect our districts and our country. When it comes to agriculture, when it comes to transportation projects, there's not a Republican way or a Democrat way to solve every problem. There's a right way and a wrong way, and the best way is to find solutions that get to actually become law, because they've become solutions that both sides can accept. I've got a great track record of addressing student debt issues in this country, a great track record of addressing some of our risk management programs when it comes to our our farmers and our producers. And I've got a great track record of addressing our infrastructure needs in this country by getting our infrastructure reauthorizations back on track ever since I got to Congress now about 9 years ago.
You are moving up the seniority ranks in the House. If the House turns to Republican control, you would be in line for a committee chairmanship. You mentioned the House Administration Committee. For people who don't understand what that one does, why don't you unpack how important it is to the general American population?
Yeah, up until the pandemic, the House Administration Committee was a quiet committee. It's the smallest full committee in Congress. But once the pandemic hit, our job in running the House campus became part of the front lines of what was happening in America. And unfortunately for the American people, they're still locked out of the U.S. Capitol to most. And they can't come here and tour Washington, D.C. And really petition their government as their constitutional right is. I'm really looking forward to once we take the majority, once I become chairman of House Administration, come January 3rd of 2023, we're going to open this campus back up to the American people. A lot of America is wide open right now, and we've got to do our best to make sure that we look at COVID and this pandemic as a risk management issue, because we're never going to get to the zero tolerance that many experts believe that we should still strive for.
Are there other committees that you would like to focus on as well?
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to being able to eventually run for chair of the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, one of the largest committees in Congress. I currently serve as the ranking member of the largest subcommittee in Congress, and that's the Highways and Transit Subcommittee. I'm looking forward to chairing that subcommittee in the next Congress, too.
That's Republican U.S. Representative Rodney Davis of Taylorville, who has represented parts of Bloomington Normal under the old maps. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.